with serious implications for pastoral practice. The image of Christ as shepherd and bishop of his church is subverted to that of a lawgiver. The pastor comes not to preach the gospel, but to uncover and discipline unremoved sin. The ministry is established to reinstate order in a church where the gospel with its gifts has been predominant. To this we respond that the office of pastor was not intended by God to bring order out of disorder or light out of chaos, but this order belongs to the gospel. The office of the ministry is gospel, and Dr. Preuss mentioned that this morning, to provide people with living reflections of Christ who sacrificed himself for them. Though the office of the ministry is entrusted with the preaching of the law, the preaching of the gospel is the unique possession of the office of the ministry. Dr. Preuss also mentioned that. Since Article 5 states that the ministry has been established for the purposes of justifying God's people by faith, it is on that account a thoroughly Christological office. It has been entrusted to preach his word, distribute his sacraments, and to project his life of sacrifice into the assembly of believers by the life and conduct of those who hold it. And that was said this morning. The Latin ministerium, the subject of the verb is instituted, certainly has its own history, which goes back to Christ's designation of himself as God's suffering servant in the light of Isaiah 53, and his asking his apostles to be servants like he was. Ministers are first Christ's servants and servants of the church for the sake of Christ. But their authority is not derived from the congregation, as Schleiermacher taught. I think in light of Carl Donfried's paper yesterday on the meaning of diaconess, not in the sense of servitude and slavery, but one who serves as a representative of God, I think what I said there and what everyone has said is going to have to be readjusted, and maybe that'll come up in the discussion. It's not the idea of the humble servant. It's the one who represents a higher authority. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who is alleged to have been the best student of Hermann Sasse, and that's like quoting the New Testament around here, when in doubt, quote your Sasse, reflected the confessional reality on this point. Quote, "Above there is the office of proclamation, and below there is the listening congregation. In the place of God and of Jesus Christ, there stands before the congregation the bearer of the office of preaching with his proclamation. The preacher is not the spokesman of the congregation, but if the expression may be allowed, he is the spokesman of God before the congregation. He is authorized to teach, to admonish, to comfort, to forgive sin, and also to retain sin. And at the same time, he is the shepherd, the pastor of the flock. The office is instituted directly by Jesus Christ himself. It does not derive its legitimation from the will of the congregation, but from the will of Jesus Christ. It is established in the congregation and by the congregation, and at the same time, it is with the congregation." The German word Predigtamt is descriptive in defining the office according to its primary function of preaching. The connection between the preaching office and the apostles is made in the German version of the treatise, which is not translated in Tappert. Quote, "Accordingly, Christ sent his disciples without distinction into the Predigtamt, preaching office, that neither one nor the other should have authority over the other. Here it is clear that the preaching office is the unique possession of the apostles, and that it is now held by ministers. Designating the office as Predigtamt, preaching office, should not be interpreted in such a way to place a wedge between preaching and sacraments, since the sacraments are, at least for the confessions in Luther, as much proclamation as preached word, from which they derive their authority. The Roman Church was a church for Luther, precisely because they did have sacraments, something he could not confidently say of the Reformed. Preaching in Augustana 5 refers not to the personal expression of faith in the private lives of Christians, but to a public and officially sanctioned proclamation, a distinction which I am not sure is made or understood. According to Chemnitz, the era of the Novatians was that they taught that reconciliation and remission of sins are to be sought and expected apart from the ministry of the gospel. End of quote. Augustana V uses the Latin word docendi, which means teaching in an official way and which is the equivalent of the Greek didasko of the New Testament, where it refers to an official proclamation of the gospel by the apostles and pastors, as for example in Matthew 28:19. Reference to the Larson Concordance shows that the word teachers and teach refer to the official proclaimers and proclamation of the preached word. The confession of the church is that which is taught in the churches and is the customary way of introducing nearly all the articles in the Augustana. Preaching can simply not be equated with the expressions of faith which all Christians make. Particularly instructive is the German rendition of the Apology 28:9-10. Tapper provides this translation of the Latin version. Priests, quote, and he does use the word priests, are called to preach the gospel and administer the sacraments to the people, end of quote. The German provides this somewhat different discourse. If one wants to call the sacrament of orders, ordains, a sacrament of the preaching office, predigtamt, so there is no difficulty in calling ordination a sacrament. For God has established the preaching office, predigtamt, and attached to it wonderful promises, end of quote. The German Apology 13 uses predigtamt as the equivalent of the Latin docendum evangelium, the teaching of the gospel. Even the possibility that ordination may be called a sacrament rules out the possibility that this is a reference to an activity which all Christians carry out in the common speaking of Christ. Teaching the gospel does not refer to a casual explanation of the Bible, but an officially sanctioned proclamation. Though the office is not derived from the function, the absence of the function suggests that the office may no longer be present. Dr. Preuss mentioned that. I think I'm the one who was redundant, and not that he was. Where sinners are not hearing the justifying word, then the function of the ministry is not being carried out, and one may also conclude that the office is not present. One may conclude that it's not present. On the other hand, the office of the ministry is not present merely because someone proclaims that it is or is carrying out its functions, as Luther explained in The Freedom of the Christian Man. Luther, in explaining that works do not constitute faith, but that faith precedes works and that works flow from faith, which is prior, uses the example of a bishop. Quote, a bishop, when he consecrates a church, confirms children, or performs some other duty belonging to his office, is not made a bishop by these works. Indeed, if he had not first been a bishop, none of these works would have been valid. They would be foolish, childish, and farcical. End of quote. This should put to rest the idea that where functions associated with the ministry are being performed, that we can be certain that the ministry is there. Attention should be paid to Apology 8, Article paragraph 48. Of course, false teachers should not be received or heard because they do not stand in the place of Christ, but are antichrists, translation from the German. A person functioning as a clergyman does not ipso facto make him a clergyman. Luther was as equally severe as the treatise in his judgment of the Roman Catholic Church, especially in regard to the content of their preaching and the private masses. He questioned their validity, amazing, and doubted whether Christ's body and blood were present. Though a priest was present, all the right words were spoken and the proper elements were in place. Still, he did not deny Rome being church or having ministry because such functions of the ministry as baptism, the reading of the gospel, absolution, communion services conducted by the clergy, called far messa, prayers, and an entire host of other signs were being carried out there. Predigtamt included all of these functions. For the apologies, false teachers could never perform a valid ministry. Luther held that, he sounds like Cyprian there, Luther held that one person could exercise a true and false ministry depending on the occasion. Luther was even more unkind of Zwingli and other Protestant forms of the Reformation than he was of Rome. Their supper simply was in every case invalid, though the proper mix of elements and word were in place. Article 7, in defining the Church as the congregation of saints, in which the gospel is purely taught and the sacraments are rightly administered, must also inform our understanding of Article 5. It speaks not of an intangible church, but of a church engaged in its regular liturgical functions, with ministers of the gospel as its appropriate liturgical leaders. The article presupposes regular church services with clergy. The Congregatio Sanctorum, the congregation of saints, is not to be identified with the ministerium. Schleiermacher should be credited with this contribution. It was the farthest thing from the Reformer's mind, including Luther's, that the laity would preach and administer the sacraments in a public way, or for that matter in a private way, representing themselves. Luther had even wanted to do away with private communion to the sick by the regular clergy. He was consistent in never authorizing lay celebrations of the Holy Communion in emergency situations, not to mention in a regularized way. It might be added that Luther did not object to bringing the consecrated elements from the church to the sick, because he did not see their illness as excluding them from the worshiping congregation. Article 7, as mentioned, presupposes a regular clergy who are preaching and administering sacraments. This is supported by Article 8, which makes explicit reference to those priests who administer the sacraments. This article begins by addressing the questions of unbelievers being mixed in among believers. But its major thrust is upholding the validity of sacraments administered by what the German calls priests who are impious. For the people, the real problem is not whether the person sitting next to them in the pew are Christians or not, but whether the priests at the altar or in the pulpit are Christians. The reference to the Latin version of Article 8, to the Donatist's refusal to accept the ministry of evil men, shows that the term ministry does not refer to a general activity common to all Christians, but to what the German version calls the preaching and sacramental activities of the priests. The lack of faith in the administrator of the sacraments does not detract from their efficacy or validity. A distinction, by the way, that Dr. Weinrich shows that maybe we have to think through again. This was an existential question for the people, since they themselves, their parents, and their children had been served by priests who had proven themselves not only to be unbelievers, but enemies of the gospel. Those who died receiving the ministration of hypocrites and unbelievers would be without hope, and they themselves may have to be rebaptized. This same issue has resurfaced in a reversed form in our time, also under the influence of Schleiermacher, with the suggestion that the level or sincerity of the faith of the clergy is a contributing factor to the efficacy of preaching, since preaching is in the seen now as the extension of faith. Somehow, sincere, heartfelt sermons win more converts than those without such explicit enthusiasm. I think today we call it an effective ministry. If we must speak of neo-Donatism, gentlemen, ladies, then let us speak of those who say that God's grace becomes more effective through the preacher's own enthusiasm. Article 8 citation of Matthew 23, with its reference to the scribes and Pharisees sitting in the seat of Moses, must be seen also as explaining Article 5. Certainly, this is not a reference to one chair in which a multitude of ecclesiastical officials found rest, and which had been preserved for a millennium or two since the Exodus. It would have hardly fit into the Ark of the Covenant. Seat is used here in the same sense that Roman Catholics speak of the Pope occupying the chair of St. Peter. To speak ex cathedra, which means speaking from the chair, is to promulgate a doctrine in an official way. The cathedral is the place or seat from which the bishop exercises his authority. The office cannot be acquainted with the holder of the office, though the holder of the office is responsible and accountable to Christ for that office at the day of judgment. Jesus' admonition to listen to the scribes and Pharisees sitting in the seat of Moses is his own recognition of the validity and efficacy of their ministry, and that their ministry was an office with valid function, even if they swallowed widows' houses when they were not working. Their unbelief and immoral conduct did not detract from their office of preaching. Article 8 makes this principle applicable within the context of the Roman Church, where the ministry of the priests rests not upon their faith, but upon the institution of Christ. Augsburg Confession is affirming the ministry of the Roman Church insofar as it carried out preaching and sacramental functions, which, as mentioned, Luther also affirmed in his private writings. Thus, the ministry is not an accumulation of functions, nor the sum total or any of its parts, but an office entrusted to some and not all. The following articles on baptism, 9, Lord's Supper 10, Confession 11, Penance 12, and the use of the sacraments 13, necessarily presuppose and must be interpreted in the light of Article 8 on the validity of preaching and administering the sacraments by evil or unbelieving priests. In turn, all of these articles have their origin in Article 5, in which the ministry as an office, of course with functions, is established. There is no thought of a disembodied preaching and sacramental activity without clergy, or assigning these functions to those who are not in the office. The connection between the office and its functions are as necessary as the connection between the person of Christ and his works, or faith to works, an analogy, as shown, employed by Luther. For the sake of convenience, we may distinguish between the essence and functions of something, but in reality, this cannot be done. These categories exist in our minds, but are not things in them, not in the things themselves. Brown may be a characteristic of hair, but brown cannot be abstracted from hair. On the other hand, the ministry cannot be the ministry without its functions. On the other hand, the office does not come into existence, because its functions are being carried out. Here we are only repeating ourselves and Luther. The ministry is not a collection of its parts, but it's a divinely given institution present in Christ and given to the Church through and in his apostles. The functions no more creates the reality than does tying apples to a tree make it an apple tree. Analogy also used by Luther in Faith and Works. Because Article 15, the article on liturgical practices, shows a remarkable resemblance to Article 14, the one on ministerial office, each can serve to interpret the other. Both 14 and 15 look backward. They are not autonomous articles, but look backward to the previous articles. Neither introduces new subjects, but speak of regulating practices already in place. Both are enabling articles. 14 speaks to the issue of setting aside persons to carry out baptism, the Lord's Supper and confession. Similarly, 15 speaks about the liturgical forms in carrying out those same sacramental functions. While the rites do not have to be conducted in the same way, they nevertheless have to be conducted. Though pastors do not have to be selected for the congregations in the same way, their being selected is not optional. Luther's practice may inform our understanding of the Augsburg Confession. Dr. Preuss made reference to this. He himself examined and ordained candidates for the ministry from his position in Wittenberg, or Bugenhagen did it, and not in the congregations as Bugenhagen had suggested, because the congregations were not equipped to examine the ministers. Though Luther articulated the doctrine of the general priesthood, the congregation did not participate in the ordination except for the prayers. It can be noted that he and Bugenhagen ordained candidates not only for Germany but for other countries. From 1537 until his death in 1546, 730 candidates were ordained in Wittenberg, where the candidate was not a German. The ordination was conducted in Latin. With our multilingual situation at our seminary, Luther's practice may have something to offer. I'm not speaking about Friday night either. Our custom of having candidates ordained in the congregation where they are first called, which is considered sacrosanct and ideal, perhaps should be readjusted or reformed by Luther's practice of ordaining them himself. In fact, I even think it's against the law to have an ordination here. We would certainly never want to get away from Luther's idea that the priest or the pastor represents everybody, everyone in the congregation. But having said this, this certainly cannot be understood in the sense of Schleiermacher's position that the ministry is not only an extension of the church, but an extension which can be adjusted by the church. What is held forth as Luther's doctrine of the general priesthood as the foundation for democratic principles is really only an Enlightenment doctrine in clothing so apparent that it is remarkable that anyone would consider this wolf Lutheran. Walter Sundberg, Luther Seminary Northwest, and we have some students who are good friends with him, observes that what passes off as Luther's position actually comes from Schleiermacher. Quote, third, there is the matter of ministry itself. Schleiermacher's work is a reaffirmation of the controversial Reformation principle of the priesthood of all believers restated for a new age. The ministry is not an exclusive privilege, end of quote. Sundberg approvingly quotes Schleiermacher that, quote, a church fellowship can be quite evangelical in spirit, even if it concedes to every Christian the right of leadership, end of quote. Everyone, every Christian has leadership. This conviction, adds Sundberg, is the heart of Schleiermacher's democratic liberalism. It also calls to mind the revolutionary claims asserted by Luther in his battle against Pope and Emperor, Church and State, end of quote. The view that ministerial authority is derived ultimately from the congregation is nothing else but ecclesiastical socialism derived from Schleiermacher and not Luther or the confessions, including Article 5. For Luther, the pastor is not an autonomous, isolated figure in the chancel, but with him is every man, woman, both young and old, master, servant, wife, maiden, parents, and children. When the pastor kneels, they kneel. When he celebrates the sacrament, they celebrate. When he preaches, they preach. When he baptizes, they baptize. So strongly did Luther feel about the congregation's participation in the priestly acts of the pastor that he felt uncomfortable with private communion for the sick and doubted whether masses offered privately with the priests by the priests were sacraments in any sense at all, even though all the parts were there. Pastor and congregation share one baptism and are one. Still past the pastors represent Christ, as did the apostles, to the congregation, as it is taught in the Augsburg Confession, the Apology, and the Treatise. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Preuss, for your fine restatement and recapitulation of the presentations by Dr. Weinrich and Dr. Preuss. For those of you who dare, Dr. Scare says he would entertain a few questions now at either of the two microphones. We have about 5 or 10 minutes before the scheduled panel discussion, which is supposed to begin at 2:45. Are there any questions? Anybody that wants to take on Dr. Preuss? Oh, excuse me, Dr. Scare. Oh, that's Dr. Scare. That's right. Any questions? Yes, would you identify yourself, please? And
Martin Noland, Pastor Christ Oak Park, Illinois. Dr. Scare, do you think that Schleiermacher's innovations are a result of his liberalism or of his background in pietism and the Brüdergemeinde?
Both, I guess. I mean, that certainly is pietism. We have a student here who is from Schwabia, and that was himself. And what I found most interesting there, their pietism has become the official religion of the land. And they sat around in a circle and having the learned men or those members of the community, they have no pastor. So I think it definitely comes from pietism and liberalism. Of course, that was Schleiermacher's problem, wasn't it? Basically, atheistic in reason and pietistic in soul. You know. That was speaking about something which I knew nothing about.
Thank you for your paper. I was just wondering whether in treating baptism, Luther had the same qualms about doing it in private as he had about celebrating the Lord's Supper.
He did. Because he suggested where an emergency baptism was done by a mother, that if the child died, she should tell the church that she had baptized the child, and if the child lived, to take it to the priest and have it baptized.
And would the baptism actually be repeated?
Yes, it would have been valid. The baptism was valid, but Luther said the important... For Luther, it was very important that it would be done in a congregational setting. I think that's the reason why he made that suggestion.
Warnman, Luxembourg. At the last session of the Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue, John Roiman, when the subject of the infamous footnote of Augustana 5 came up, said that this was not Tappert's footnote, but this was a direct quote from something in the Bekentenen Schriften, only nobody had the Bekentenen Schriften there at the time, so that we couldn't check it out. I couldn't find what he was talking about. Could you enlighten
me? I'm sorry, I can't. I just know it's in the footnote. I was aware of it in the Bekentenen Schriften, which is just the opposite. I don't know. Anyway, we're not to use, according to this morning's lecture, we're not to use the word difference between clerical and laity, so that settles the issue. No discussion.
Wiest, Milwaukee. Dr. Scher, recently our pastoral conference had occasion to study the mission document released by the Synod, which is based on Romans. And in the Bible study section, which we were going through, it seemed like the method was to take Paul's call and Paul's mission and imply that that was true for every baptized Christian. By baptism, all Christians are missionaries. Yeah. Are you familiar with this document, and have you seen that same methodology at work in it?
Happily not, no. No, I'm aware of that document, but I'm more concerned when you go to a synodical convention and they have on the backboard, "Even as the Father has sent me, send I you," with a reference that everybody there is being spoken of, and that's words explicitly referring to the establishment of the apostolate. Also in Matthew 28, it's another one too, which is given universal, that's applied universally. If you want to check it out in the Lutheran Dogmaticians, I can quote that too. They use it for the office of the ministry.